My name is Dr. Milchos, and I am the president of the board of directors of ICDL. This month is a very important month as we are celebrating Autism Awareness Month. We talk about inclusivity and accessibility, where we view autism as part of the neurodiverse movement, where it recognizes and respects the diversity of the human brain functioning and behavior. It suggests that the neurological differences, such as ASD or even ADHD, dyslexia, or dyspraxia, are not disorders, but rather a normal variation of the brain development. As such, neurodiverse advocates are fighting for accepting and celebrating the different ways that people perceive and interact with the world. It is a movement that was primarily recognized by autism self-advocates to recognize the unique traits, attributes, and talents of the individual, rather judging them based on their diagnosis, by seeing other diversities as a strength rather than a weakness or a social ill. I wanted to use my personal story to inspire others and to ensure that equal rights are implemented for all. Together, we are stronger. Let's hold hands and celebrate the unique difference and wonderful gifts of neurodiversity. Happy Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month.
You're listening to Affect Autism, where affect is the number one tool we use in supporting child development through playful interactions. Hello, listeners and viewers. Welcome back. I'm Daria Brown, and I have DIR expert trainer Nagwa Kheder. She is an early intervention specialist in Cairo, Egypt. She's been practicing DIR floor time since 2014 and was involved in opening the first DIR floor time center recently in the Middle East called Etfasel. That's in Arabic, which means connect in English. We met in person last year at the DIR International Conference in New York City, and I've been planning to do a podcast ever since. I'm thrilled to finally have you here today, Nagwa.
Hi, Daria. I'm so happy to finally do this. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, today our topic is affect and regulation in Middle Eastern culture, which is part of the I in the DIR model, individual differences. I know that depending on the area, there's nuances, but it's very expressive, very warm, very rhythmical. Some of the languages are very rhythmical. I can imagine that it's quite different than American culture. And so when we think about affect, my site is Affect Autism. DIR mobilizes children's development through the use of affect and helping children stay regulated. We use a lot of affect. So I can imagine that has a huge impact on the way you implement floor time in the Middle East.
Yeah, as an Arab culture, our affect is always, as Jackie Bartel says, fluorescent. We tend to have big affect. We tend to use our hand a lot, use our facial expressions. Our voices are a bit louder than most cultures. I don't want to generalize, but this is usually the thing, that we're very emotional. We get close to each other sometimes, like physically. And learning that in DIR, affect needs to be changeable, or affect can be changeable, or we don't have to have the same affect throughout the entire time or with all kids the same way. This was a bit hard to explain at the beginning, and it was a bit hard even for myself when I first started practicing, because I'm used to that affect is like praise. The way you use affect is the way you praise a child, is the way you tell the child, "Oh, well done, you did a good job." And this is how you're playful, or you're affective, you're using affective charged relationships or interactions. But learning that in DIR, that we tailor our affect, or we tailor how we use our affect based on the child's D and I. So it's not just a general way of speaking with everyone, or a general way of dealing with everyone. So this was a bit hard to adapt in the society and our culture. And even with parents, just explaining the idea of affect and how affect is very, very important, and it can come in so many different phases.
Just to give one little example, when my son was a baby until about 2 or 3 years old, we had Middle Eastern neighbors in our condominium upstairs that we played with because the boy was the same age as my son, and they were Lebanese, and the mother was very expressive, very dominant. She had a very big personality, and she just had to look at her son and say, "Excuse me?" And he would immediately like freeze. And there was no doubt that she was the boss, right? So she really led, sort of led that mother role in a very authoritative way. And I remember thinking like, oh, I need to do more of that. Because, I was, I my son had brain inflammation. I was in that post-traumatic, like, oh, I'm going to do everything for my sweetheart because he almost died, right? And I remember, especially around limit setting and that having that affect that's more firm and a firm tone can be a good way for giving the child the cue that we're setting a limit. So I'm curious in, of course, that's one little small example in Middle Eastern culture, if that is more the norm, where it's a very dominating kind of firm limit setting affect, how does that work with a child who maybe isn't responding to those limits?
Yeah, so this example actually is quite similar to the culture here as well in Egypt and to many Arab cultures that we have even a joke about it, like the stare. Like you give the child a stare and then you just stare at him and then the child stops or supposed to stop what they're doing. But again, there's no relationship when this happens. Like it's usually, okay, I'm gonna do this for the child to stop something and that's it. And when I see families in therapy and when we try to coach parents and try to help them understand how to actually bond with their kids, and they say, yeah, but I look at them sometimes and I stare, but they don't stop it. Or they don't listen or they don't come immediately. It's how we were, some of us, I don't want to say everyone, but some of us were raised. Like you have to set very harsh boundaries, and this is the way you set it. And if your child doesn't listen or doesn't comply when you do that, then you have a problem. Then your way of parenting is the problem, not how you're doing it, or not because of this method is lack this method lacks any relationship or lacks any reciprocity between you two. No, it's just he's there, he stops. So it doesn't really work.
That whole idea of promoting the back and forth and meeting the child where they're at must be a hurdle in the same way that it's a hurdle in North America with parents that are more behaviorally have that behavioral mindset and the way they were raised too, like expecting compliance. So how do you start to model that for parents? How does that look? How do you explain the whole concept of regulation to them?
That's very good because I was just moving, like I wanted to move to regulation from this point. So we try to show the parents, help parents to look at their child as an individual. Even if they have many kids, even if they have many children, they have twins, but each one is individual, each one is unique, each one has their own strengths, own weaknesses that need support. So just having a generalized way of parenting or a generalized affect for every child and having the idea that it will work with anyone, it won't. So it's our role to help parents see that, to help parents see how kids are unique, how kids are individuals, and look at their individual profile rather than their diagnosis or any label that they have. And we do that sometimes by just having them in the session with us, seeing us play with the kids, modeling how affect should look like, asking them, okay, what do you think happened now? And what do you think, why do you think this happened? Just trying to let them be more reflective rather than just us telling them what to do. Because again, this will be exactly like what they're doing. Like they're staring at their child and they expect them to just stop it. So us telling them to stop it won't help either, if I'm making any sense.
Right. And I imagine that there must be a cultural, I don't want to say stigma, but a cultural view around disability that might be different as well, also depending on what country in the Middle East. But I'm guessing, I don't know, you can let me know, that the caretaking falls mostly on the women in the family. And so there might be different family influences where the dad expects the child to be compliant, and you know what is happening? Is there is the mother doing something that's not working? How does all of the how do all those cultural differences impact the family system?
So in the Arab world, or most of the Arab countries, our individual differences, our culture individual differences are very different than those in the America or in US or Europe, because we are a big family. Like, it's not just the small family, it's not just the father and the mother and the siblings. The grandparents are there too, the aunts are there too, the uncles, the in-laws, like everyone is involved somehow.
And
And
probably lots of children, cousins and siblings as well.
exactly. And a lot of people do live in the same building as their family too. So a lot of family coming up and down, going in and out of their house. So everyone is involved in everyone's life somehow. But yet the role of the mother remains the one who, okay, I'm gonna blame the mom, or I'm gonna say the mom is the one who's responsible for everything. Even though like everyone else could have like a say, or anyone else could have an impact on the child's therapy or the child's life or the child's upbringing. But again, the role of the mom remains to be the most powerful, and to be the, she's responsible for everything. She's responsible for the child's progress if there is no progress, or like she's the one we go to and say, okay, why didn't you do this or that?
Must be a lot of pressure.
It is a lot of pressure, and it is hard when you also try to coach the parent, the father or the mother, and usually it's the mom. Usually the mom is the one coming into the session wanting to learn more and wanting to do this more. And it's hard because she'll go and tell you that, okay, but when I go back to the big family, or when I go back to everyone else, they expect him to comply, because regulation remains in the Middle East, or people still believe that regulation is compliance. If the child does not comply, then the child is not regulated, because he's not following orders, or he's not behaving well, or he's not sitting still. So this means that this is a behavioral issue, or the child needs more discipline. So even looking at regulation here is different.
So, how do you foster the mother's regulation? Because that will be a big part of influencing the child's regulation.
Exactly. That's a very good question. Recently, we created like a workshop online course for mothers to understand their own individual differences. Because we always speak to them about their child's individual differences, their child's sensory systems. But we started educating the moms, or just helping them understand their own individual differences. So sometimes it's not because you're a bad, it's never because you're a bad mom, but sometimes it's not because you're too busy or you're too distracted. Sometimes it's just because your system is full. Like you need a break, or you need to regulate first. And we can't regulate our kids. Like, we can't do co-regulation if we're not regulated. So this is something that we try to educate parents. We try to let mom know that they need this as well. It's not just their child. They need to be regulated. They need to understand what makes them dysregulated? What makes them regulated? What is the trigger? What is the thing that they need to go to? Who is their co-regulator? Because again, we also talk about the child's co-regulator, but as a mom, I'm sure you all have this co-regulator person, or a friend, or maybe a pet, or something that we do that brings us, okay, joy, and okay, now I'm feeling better, feeling much more relaxed, and I can learn and I can interact. So this is something else that we try to help moms with.
I can imagine that in a collectivist culture, that might be easier in some respects because you have your sisters or your grandmother there, your mother there. You have other people to sort of take over when you just need a break and you need a rest. Also, maybe the old saying of it takes a village to raise a child. That cultural aspect is still preserved in many places in the Middle East where it doesn't fall onto single family members. It's more of a group effort, which in a lot of ways really benefits the child a lot more than just being isolated. So how do you see that interplay? I can imagine that there are, I mean, we have a number of Middle Eastern parents come to ICDL's parent support group every week from different countries. And, the mothers are just so dedicated, they will do anything to help their children. And so I imagine that they do recruit other family members to help with this advocacy for their kids.
It's a blessing for many to have this huge support system, to have so many people who are willing to come and help and support you. But sometimes parents would actually tell us that they wish they can have more space, and they wish they can have their routine that they want, establish a routine that they want, or because again, we are a very behavior-dominated country, and we are a very behavior-dominated region. So just being a mom, explaining to her dad, who's much older, what individual differences are, or what is a sensory need, or what does the child need right now, or why is he dysregulated, could be a bit hard to them. He's just being spoiled, or she just needs to be more strict with him. She just gives him the stare so he could just stop. So it could be a blessing for some, but for others, like, no, we just need some space because it's really hectic to have everyone involved in our lives. But just letting them know, empowering the parents again, as we all do in DIR, and just explaining to them how DIR works, why we're doing what we're doing, just reflecting. And I think the most important thing is to teach parents how to be reflective, how to look at things from their own way, and to, oh yeah, I think I did that because of this. Just them reaching the answer is much better than me giving them some strategies and that's it. So again, this is something new here, and we're trying to get people on board as much as possible.
How much involvement do you see from other family members? Do you see that they're willing to at least come and be open to what you're sharing?
Moms are usually the more invo most involved. We see dads sometimes, but they would be the ones who come in for the meetings, or just like check-in meetings or progress meetings, things like that. But usually the mom is the one who's coming inside of the session, sitting on the floor and wanting to explore and learn and play. And this is also because culturally, dads, you don't really interact this way with their kids. Like, when you see a playful dad, a fun dad, people usually envy the mom, like his wife, like, oh, she has a very helpful husband, because here it's usually the mom and the dad is the one who's working till late, who is doing like the serious job, and the mom is doing everything else.
Right. So let's get into how you use affect culturally.
So we usually, as I said earlier, that we have very loud voices. We speak with our hands too much. Sometimes we like to kiss and hug, and it's like this no boundaries. Like, even if we see a therapist who sees the child and starts immediately tickling him because this is how she's playing with the child. So from a DIR lens, this doesn't always fit with the child's individual differences. Sometimes you have to, okay, tell the mom or the parent or even a therapist that this child doesn't really like loud noises, so you need to keep your voice a bit quieter than usual, or you need to speak slowly, or you need to have different tones in your voice. You don't have to speak all like mono.
Monotone.
Yeah, that you don't have to speak in monotone. So you need to go up and down with your voice, up and down with your facial expressions, change them, but take your cues from the child. If you think the child is not really responding to you, if you think the child started to withdraw from the interaction, then we need to change it. Then we need to see how we can entice him back in. And this is the hardest part, I have to say, when we try to play with our affect, or we try to experiment with our affect, because, okay, but I'm doing it. We hear parents sometimes say, yeah, I'm doing it, but okay, let's reflect on how you're doing it. And we see that she's praising you. Because again, like, oh, that's very good, well done, bravo. And she goes back to being quiet, and suddenly we're just praising the child. So it would, of course, impact the regulation and impact the rest of the hour we spent together, or the 40 minutes we spent together, because of how we need to, okay, we need to pause, observe, and tailor our affect. We need this attunement with the child, and then everything would come.
Right. And I imagine that's always has the pressure of compliance around it, which makes it hard. Do you find that attunement is different in your culture?
Yeah, I find that when a mom, especially moms, are very attuned to their child's needs and very attuned to their child's emotions and tries to advocate for them, usually people perceive that as you're just finding excuses for your child. So I think it's different in the sense that people don't really honor it yet. And to them, these are just excuses, or you don't know it, we know it. And this is something else we hear a lot from parents when they come from different types of therapies or from other services, that usually the practitioner or the specialist or the therapist would tell them that we understand your child. We know why he's doing that. You're just spoiling him, or you're just giving him excuses. So a lot of the times, parents, they don't trust their intuition, like they don't trust their gut, and they say, like, maybe I understand wrong, or maybe my child really is just being manipulative, for example. So it's different in the sense, yeah.
Yeah, and I imagine that follows with maybe guilt later on if the child, if, you know, I had a podcast with Dr. Kathy Platzman called Avoiding the Blame, which I'll put a link to in the blog post, where we talk about how you can't know what you didn't know at the time, and you have to move forward, you have to look forward. But yeah, I can imagine that in some cases there has to be that big shift in mindset.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So what happens when the children are school age? Because I imagine the schools are very compliance based as well, like they all are here as well.
So we try, like in school, of course, like most of the schools are behavioral, and they just want everything to be fixed. They want everything to be fixed and quickly, like easy fix. This is how it should be done. But a lot of our kids, like a lot of kids who come to us at the center, they do have like a teacher aide or integration teacher with them in school. So this, we try to, okay, we need to have a good relationship with him. You need to work on your relationship. You need to be like his anchor in school. So he comes to you and you come to him and you go to him and you see what's happening. And when we go to school meetings, and like even with my own kids, I try to just explain how relationships are very important, and how we say things matter, and how we say things differ, and how we say things impact how the child will answer our questions, or how the child will interact with us. So I just try to always explain and stress on the point that if there is no relationship with the teacher, the child will not have a good experience in the classroom. That child's regulation will be impacted, or a lot of things just fall apart when we don't have strong relationships in school.
How receptive are they to that message?
Some are, some but we try, like we keep trying. Some people are very convinced, but they say, but this takes longer, like this takes longer. But yeah, it might take longer, but at the end, what we'll see is completely different. Like the child will reach, and what you will reach with the child will be amazing and you'll see amazing results and you'll be so proud and happy. So why not just give it a try? And when who the people who actually listen and who actually work on the relationships, they see wonders. They see how important it is. They see how when they try, tailor their interaction, when they try to read the child's cues and focus on regulation before focusing on skill building or compliance or just teaching the child skills to go through the day, they see that. So they go, okay, yeah, this makes sense. And a lot of the times these teachers join 101.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
DIR 101, an
Yes.
introduction to DIR and DIR floor time through the International Council of Development and Learning. Yeah, the intro course really lays out that whole groundwork and theory with examples. I mean, honestly, Nagua, everything we talked about is not doesn't sound that different than North America because we're all working on the same kind of things. Definitely there's cultural differences in the family and the family structure. But you know, there's more and more Middle Eastern families in North America too. And so they're immersed in the North American culture and also looking for services and in the same kind of way. What stands out to you as really being unique to Egypt or the Middle East?
We're very emotional. So when we explain DIR to them and when we speak about the capacities, the functional emotional capacities, they can relate and they understand that, yeah, I want my child to do that, or I want my child to be able to understand that or reach that. It's because of how emotional we are.
So do you think that emotional aspect helps with the effective interactions?
Yeah, it does. Like when you just explain to them that, no, I want you to show your child how you're feeling. It's not just about being happy all the time. Show the ch child how you're feeling when you're playing with them or when you're interacting with them. So it's easy for them to understand that because we are emotional and we tend to open up to each other very quickly and very like easily open up and share a lot of things. So when you come and explain this part to them, a lot of them is like, okay, that's easy, I can do that.
And I imagine the more you foster these interactions and these experiences, the more they start to feel like, oh, okay, I get it. I get it.
Yeah, it's just how we guide them that makes the difference. If we just tell them, yeah, because a lot of the people who come to us, a lot of the families who come to us have been through different kinds of therapy before. Some of them have been told that you shouldn't show any emotion to your child. You should, when a child is doing a task, you should like have a mask face on. When the child finishes, you just again give them a praise and that's it. So when they come to us and we explain the whole idea of fostering emotions and working on emotions, they like, yeah, this makes sense. Like, this is what fits us. This is what looks like the normal or the day-to-day. This is what looks like the day-to-day activity or the day-to-day interactions that we have. So, yeah, we want to work on our emotions. We don't want to ignore them.
So, given that that's sort of the personality of the culture, what about socially? Like, is it socially inappropriate to be that way in public or in schools or as the child grows? Is there more of a stigma? Is there a need for more advocacy for disability in the Middle East? Do you think it's different?
So lately there has been great like people who are doing great awareness campaigns. We've been doing awareness campaigns ourselves in Etwasl and things are getting better, but the stigma of the label of having any diagnosis is still there. This is something that we're working on, that okay, we don't want to look at the diagnosis or the box that we put the child in. We want to look at the individual profile. We want to look at the strengths, not just the weaknesses, like because there's so much the child can offer, but just looking at his diagnosis and putting him, okay, he can do this or he won't be able to do it, is hard, and it's hard on the parents. Still, socially, some moms struggle taking their child and going somewhere and like having breakfast outside with their friends, like in a public place with their friends or at the mall, because they're scared, they're embarrassed if their child like throws a meltdown, or if a child is wearing like a headset or starts to do any stimming in any way, that people might look at them and might judge them or tell them, okay, why is your child doing that? Because again, we're very involved in each other's life, and you'll find people walking by and asking, oh, what's happening? Do you need any help? When you sometimes, okay, yeah, I need help, but other times, like, no, I don't want any help. Like, I can handle it. So I think it's still, we need to talk about it more. We need to talk about our needs more, our individual differences more, our challenges, and how we can support each other rather than just judging each other or trying to, okay, tell each other what to do. And I think because we like to tell each other what to do a lot.
Yeah. Just the fact that a DIR floor time center has opened, makes me assume that the need is there, the interest is there, people want to support autistic kids. Do you find that this is more what's happening?
Yeah, at the beginning it was a bit hard, I have to be honest, because they wanted to fix the problems rather than understand the child realistically. But as we go, we see parents who are more committed. We see parents who understood the idea, who got the idea, and who felt that this is very close to their heart and this is what they want. So I think like we're taking baby steps, and I'll quote Jackie Bartel again. One by one by one.
Yes. I know that at the Ocalic Online, which is an autism conference in Ohio online every year, there were more publications presented about culture in the Middle East and autism. And so the awareness is out there. I will put a link to some of those in the blog post for today. I think they did a study in Iran, and there was a another one as well. I can't remember which countries, but do you have any kind of ties with any researchers or universities, or do you know if there's research happening around autism in general, and then more specifically around floor time or developmental approaches?
So recently there has been a research going on, and we're supporting that in the 12th, and we have a flyer here for anyone who wants to participate. It's about attachment, and it's a research based about the dyad between the child and the mom, and it's a very developmental based research. But as for autism, again, it's mostly behavioral things that's happening in Egypt. Yeah.
Yep, I think it's still the norm everywhere. Yeah. So, as a parent of an autistic child myself, I think about the parent journey. I wonder if you could describe maybe there's been a family you've been with for a number of years, what the parent journey sort of looks like, because we've sort of covered that whole the diagnosis, the scariness, my child isn't complying, to sort of getting to understand the child as an individual, their individual differences, how to tailor your interactions to them. Then you start to see them light up maybe, and then the parents are like, oh, okay. Okay, I like this approach. And what have you seen on the parent journey in your years as a floor time practitioner?
So a child comes in mind, like a specific family comes in mind. This child used to come to the center, not the center, it was a previous center I used to work in, and he used to come and take a lot of sessions. Like it was a multidisciplinary center with many services being provided. And the mom stopped me once and started asking about floor time. Like, what is floor time? What do you do? And how can it help my son? So we started by, okay, I'm gonna see him. You can come in and sit. He used to be a child who didn't want to interact with anyone and would cry a lot and have a lot of strong emotional reactions to things. And when she sat in the room and she was like, oh, he's looking at you. To hear that was a surprise. Like, oh, he's interested in something, but you're not doing anything. I wasn't actually doing anything at the time. I really remember. I was just playing with whatever he was playing with, but quietly. So my affect wasn't loud, I wasn't speaking a lot, I was just observing and doing what he was doing. And a click happened somehow. And she was like, okay, I want to have weekly meetings and I want to attend the sessions. Like, I said, of course, you can come in, you can attend the sessions. Not all sessions were great, of course. Some sessions I had to do more work than other times. Some sessions I had to like leave everything behind and just focus on emotional regulation, which is a piece that we forget sometimes here. We tend to focus on the strategies, the cognitive level, on the sensory tools that we can use, but we forget to focus on the emotional capacity or the emotional component of the regulation. So this is what we used to do. By the time the child would see me in the lobby of the center, and he would go like wave at me, like he wants to come and play with me. And she would tell me that he's very excited to come and play with you. He couldn't say my name, like he couldn't say Nagua, but he would say like a letter, like a syllable. And she knows that, okay, he really likes the session and there's something there that makes him happy, that makes him want to go there. And by the time the mom started playing herself, playing, and time goes by, and she started, okay, I'm going to play, I'm going to show to join the session, I'm going to play, I'm going to participate. And we would see great things come online and great things happen, like how he would problem solve, how he would plan things and wait and get things that didn't have to do anything with each other, but he would combine them into something. And the mom was amazed by our approach, and we spent like a year together. And this was one of the children that I really, really like. That has special place in my heart, and his mom. And she read Engaging Autism, and she was very curious to learn more and eager to learn about the floor time. And when she comes to the sessions, she will be, okay, I did this and that. And then the child joined school, and she would tell me what happened in school and how can we tackle this from a developmental point of view. Okay, so they're dealing with him using the behavior approach. How can we deal with him? How can we deal with the situation using floor time? So again, like, okay, we can change mindsets. It will take time, but it happens. Like, and when it does happen and they see the spark that floor time brings to the table, they cling to it and they are usually very happy with it.
It is amazing. It's amazing to watch the transformation, and the dedication of parents.
It is amazing when you actually it is amazing, and it's even more, I find it more realistic when we explain to them that we need to have realistic expectations, or we need to understand that we have expectations, we're waiting for things to happen, but we need to celebrate the process. And when parents shift their lens from, I want to reach the goal, I want my child to achieve this goal, to, oh, my child did so many things in this journey, they start to appreciate it more, and they start to say that, okay, this is working. Like, this approach is actually working.
And at that point, do family members come on board? Wonderful.
It's an amazing, amazing approach. I'm very
Yes.
biased.
Now, one thing we didn't talk about yet is are the type of services that are available in Egypt. Do you have in Cairo occupational therapy, speech therapy, all of the therapies that we talk about?
Yeah, we do have speech therapy, and we have speech pathologists, speech therapists, speech practitioners. And as for occupational therapy, we don't have an occupational therapy school in Egypt, like university. So most of the occupational therapists who are here in Egypt, most of the OTs are usually Jordanian, Lebanese, or Palestinian, because these are the places that they have the universities in. And we have on board a Jordanian Palestinian with us.
So, is occupational therapy in general something that's novel to Egypt, or do people automatically associate once you get a diagnosis, you need occupational therapy?
No, people actually associate the diagnosis with behavioral approaches. Like, once you get diagnosed, you need to get your child into any behavioral services. But when time goes by and things aren't going as planned, okay, maybe OT would help.
Okay, so it's not as much a part as it is
As it should
maybe.
be.
Do you find that that's a struggle from your point of view when you see that children really need some kind of more sensory integration happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because a lot of the things we see in schools, like a lot of the behaviors or the actions or the struggles that we see in schools for kids, they need occupation therapy. They need a sensory, they need an OT in every school. There should be an OT in every school, I have to say that. So I think OT is very, very needed in Egypt, and it's very, very important. We do have a lot of people who are implementers, meaning they have trained under an OT and now they're practicing, but they can't do the full assessment, they can't put a full plan, so it's still a big need here.
So I know that you're a trainer with the International Council on Development and Learning, and you teach online courses. You mentioned sometimes the teachers at the schools take DIR 101. Did you mean the online course, or do you do in-person offerings to teach about floor time as well?
Some teachers do join the online one-on-one courses, but the majority would rather come and have the course live. They want the one-to-one interaction. They want the physical interaction, the live interaction. So don't think the online culture is big here yet. People would rather know, I want to come physically. I want to take notes. I want to ask you questions. I want to talk to the person next to me, understand why they're here, where are they from. So usually when I do courses in Arabic, I do them in Egypt.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
And I did three courses in Jordan. So I traveled to Jordan and I did the one-on-one there. It was very, very good.
So you get a good reception. Is it families, parents that take it? Is it educators, therapists?
Therapists. When in Jordan,
Okay.
it's usually therapists and it's usually OTs and SLPs who
Oh,
come and take the
interesting.
course.
Around Western cultures, there's a lot of advocacy from adult autistics. Does any of that exist in the Middle East, as far as you know?
So there are some platforms on Instagram that are by autistic adults. There are few, there are not many. But we started to see that, and we started to see those platforms come online and advocating and saying, okay, I've been diagnosed recently with autism, and it has been so enlightening for a lot of people to see different faces of autism, to see, okay, this is someone with a master's degree who is a therapist and coming and saying that I've been recently diagnosed. Someone else who's in school starts to talk about how school is difficult for her because she is autistic and going through it with her sensory differences, how it's impacting her day and posting about it every day. So we're starting to see some of those, and it's very useful and it's very good for others, for parents whom their children has just been diagnosed, or they're looking, okay, I want to hear it, but from the other side. I want to know it, but from the other side.
Right. And I mean, as that continues, I think we'll start to see a shift. We really are in this shift with the neurodiversity movement. I noticed that when we hopped on this Zoom call, you had the infinity neurodiversity symbol as your background. So yeah, that's
That's
really
it, Wassel's. That's it, Wassel's. Logo.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. So we'll put a picture of that in the blog post as well.
I'll
Well,
send
thank you so much, Nagwa, for sharing
you.
all this information with us. I hope that families that are listening, maybe your Middle Eastern cultural family, and hopefully you learned something from this. If you'd like to reach out and ask Nagwa any questions, you can get in touch with me, and I can put you in touch. Thank you so much, Nagwa.
Thank you so much, Daria. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Until next time, here's to choosing play and experiencing joy every day.
April marks Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month, a time for us to come together and celebrate the uniqueness and brilliance of individuals on the autism spectrum. It is a month where we not only raise awareness, but also foster acceptance and inclusion in our communities. Autism, often misunderstood, is not a limitation, but a diverse spectrum of abilities, strengths, and perspectives. Each person on the spectrum brings their own vibrant colors to the canvas of humanity. And they possess the unique talents, creativity, and insights that enrich our world in profound ways. Yet, despite the incredible contributions of individuals with autism, they continue to face barriers of acceptance and inclusion. Too often, they encounter misunderstanding, stigma, and discrimination. It is our collective responsibility to break down these barriers to create a world where every individual, regardless of their neurodiversity, is valued, respected, and even given equal opportunities. We must strive for a community where differences are not just tolerated, but embraced, where empathy and kindness prevail over judgment and fear. This starts with education, educating ourselves and others about autism, its challenges and its gifts. It's about fostering environments that celebrate the diversity to accommodate the unique needs of every individual. We must also advocate for policies and practices that promote inclusion and accessibility in education, employment, healthcare, and even beyond. Everyone deserves a chance to reach their full potential, and we must ensure that individuals with autism and those with different neurodiversities have the support and resources they need to thrive. But above all, let us listen. Let us listen to the voices of individuals with autism and their families. Let us learn from their experiences, their joys, their struggles, and even their triumphs. Let us amplify their voices to empower them to advocate for themselves. Today, as we raise awareness and celebrate autism awareness and acceptance, let us reaffirm our commitment to building a more inclusive and compassionate world. Let us pledge to stand in solidarity with the autism community, to champion their rights, and to embrace the beauty of neurodiversity. Let us all remember that our differences are what makes us unique and extraordinary. Let us celebrate the unique abilities of every individual for its diversity, that we find strength, resilience, and boundless possibilities. Thank you.